Hello, everybody. Okay, so everybody's here, or okay, yeah.
I think so.
So today I want to present something about ADS-CFT and quantum gravity, or ADS-CFT from a quantum gravity point. The main question I'm going to be focusing on is what exactly is quantum ADS-CFT from a quantum gravity point of view. And I've already given this talk in Zakopane, so some people there, you know, read some familiar slides, but it might be useful to go again. Next slide. Yeah, what I say is that there's a paper out which has been, which is available on the net. The number was on the slide. ADS-CFT has a very, very long history. And there is a very vast literature on the subject. However, I want to focus here on one particular aspect of ADS-CFT, which is now the meaning of ADS-CFT and its relationship with background independent quantum gravity. And if you start to ask such questions, there's not so many the literature reduces drastically, and in fact, I've highlighted here a few key papers that were key, that are key for the story I'm going to tell. There's a paper by Witten, which contains the original formulation of ADS-CFT. There's a series of papers by Scanderi on what's so-called the holographic normalization group, where in some propose a very gravitational way to understand this correspondence at the semi-classical level. There's an influential paper by De Boer and Verlinde on the meaning of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation there. And then there's somewhere in some paper of Maldacena at the end, almost in an appendix on the paper of non-Gaussian infinity. It's interesting, the Schrodinger picture which is sketched there. So what I'm going to say about ADS-CFT is I can't claim total originality on that, because lots of the portion of what I'm going to say, you can find that part of the literature here and there, but I don't think there is anywhere in the literature where people have addressed a whole series of questions I'm going to come up in a consistent manner. And then this way of looking at the problem will allow us to propose also a reconstruction formula. Next slide. So, what is the purpose of this talk? So the original motivation for me, why am I looking at ADS-CFT? Well, recently there was a paper by Witten on 3D quantum gravity where he proposed a CFT that would be some equivalent or some definition, as he puts it, of 3D quantum gravity. On the other hand, you know, and in his paper, in some sense, he emphasized that maybe, you know, solving quantum gravity means finding the corresponding CFT, and we don't have to worry about the bug, can that somehow the CFT is a definition of 3D quantum gravity. However, you know, we have an independent, or, you know, at least lots of us express, and if you believe that we have a fully consistent independent definition of what 3D quantum gravity is, which exists, you know, independently whether there is a cosmological constant or not, or whether the space-time is admits asymptotic ends or not. So a priori, the definition is independent of any CFT definition, and that's a great opportunity because it allows us to look at the two sides, the bulk side and the quantum gravity side and the CFT side, and then ask the question: well, can we prove or disprove the proposal of Witten? You know, comparing what we know about 2 plus 1 quantum gravity and what we know about CFT. So, you know, that was the central question. Can I, you know, I'm supposed to be a specialist in 3D gravity, knowledgeable there. What should I do to prove that this proposal is right or to prove that this proposal is wrong? So this led to many other questions which are, in fact, independent of 2 plus 1. So, when you know, the first one is that, okay, is there a formulation of ADS-CFT that allows us to prove? Is there a way to formulate this conjecture that is, you know, provable in principle? What it really means is when you want to understand exactly what is the supposed exact dictionary between quantum gravity and conformality theory. Another question that arises there is that is the correspondence expected? Is this correspondence between one theory of quantum gravity and one theory and one conformality theory, which sometimes looks like it's formulated that way, or is it something more subtle, like a correspondence between one theory of quantum gravity, which has many solutions, and then the solutions correspond to many different things? So is it a one-to-one correspondence, or is it a one-to-many correspondence? Now, if it's a one-to-many correspondence, how can you even talk about the CFT associated or dual to quantum gravity? That's a puzzle that might arise, or that will arise, as we will see. Now, another thing which was key for me, which I think has not really been addressed in the literature, so was often stated that NDS-CFT is a background-independent formulation of quantum gravity, but it always refers to some type of classical metric and classical background with a fixed asymptotic end, and that's not exactly what you would get in a in a background-independent formulation of gravity. So one key question, in fact, it's the key to the resolution, that's the nice thing about it, is that one key question is to ask, well, is there a background-independent formulation of this correspondence? The next thing is that, do we care if we're only interested in to quantum gravity? What I mean by that is that is ADS-CFT a property of, string theory and particular solutions of string theory, or is it something more genuinely intrinsic to quantum gravity? I mentioned that some people say that, CFT can be, think that it can be a definition of quantum gravity. If it's so, then it means that maybe you should be able to reconstruct the bulk from the CFT, but how do you do that? Is it really possible? Can you propose a reconstruction formula? What is the equation behind this reconstruction? So essentially the purpose of this talk is to give answers to all these questions, or at least to address them. And then also foster, discussions and questions. And you might have some other questions about ADS-CFT that I haven't put there, as you can propose them now. I would be happy. But these were the list of questions that I wanted to answer about ADS-CFT. Okay.
I just have a small comment, which is kind of on the side, but perhaps important for this correspondence. This correspondence was used very, very early on to claim that the energy in asymptotically ADS space-time in odd space-time dimensions was non-zero. And this has, several of us, particularly me and Das and I and several other people have shown that this is not the case. Mm-hmm. And so our community has actually provided input into constructing a better dictionary than was available just by looking at the correspondence and taking the quantum gravity theory completely seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I agree. In fact, I haven't mentioned that. I think it's an important point here that this is an interesting field also because there is a lot of cross-fertilization there. That is, there are certain key questions that we have, like background independence or the problem you mentioned, which have not been really addressed, from some other point of view. And having this questioning, having these techniques bring new results, as I hope I will convince you or I will convince people working in ADS-CFT for a long time. But, and the same thing on the other side, that it's a certain statement that they make, are important for us. So I agree with that it's an interesting field for that because there's a lot of combined expertise or combined questioning that we can confront. My original point was this confrontation between these two things. But I agree. I won't talk about this energy problem and discussion, but can bring it back at some point. Okay, next slide. So before going to the quantum case, let me look at the classical basis of AES, CST, and a bit about the classical geometry. So suppose we look at D plus 1. So D will be always the dimension of the boundary of the space-time, and the space-time will always be D plus 1 dimensional. So let's look at the D plus 1 dimensional space-time M, which is a bulk metric G, which is solutions of Einstein equation with a cosmological constant lambda. I read the next equation on the terms of the cosmological.
We don't need another big shot. The gravity is quite on the contrary. It's exactly the place where we can bring
talk,
we
mostly talk about
the
ADS case, which corresponds to
make him or her grow
at
the big shot. Like, even if they leave us, we
here
it is.
And I will always refer to the ADS case, but you have to keep in mind
sure,
that most
nice
of what I'm going
to
say is also true in the Sutton case. And we can have a discussion
sure
about that.
I
might point down, what algorithm is meant to the Sutton case. But
then that's people here to assume that we can attract.
So if I look at a space time like that, which is with the solution of Einstein equation with the cosmological constants, if you assume that M is conformally compact, then if you assume that there is a defining function, which is zero on the boundary of M, sorry, the formula say rho minus 1 is equal to 0, it should say rho is 0 on the boundary, so the inverse image of 0 is the boundary, that's what this first equation says. And then the derivative of rho is different from 0 on the boundary. Then you can define a conformally, conformal matrix, which is G bar, which is rho squared times G, where G is the physical metric, such that this conformal metric extends smoothly to the boundary of X. That's what it means to have a conformal compactive equation of the state. Then what's interesting is that the Einstein equation implied that the vector d mu rho, which is the vector somehow normal to the slice at infinity, this conformal metric, is plus 1 in the ADS case and minus 1 in the Sutton case. So it means that in ADS, the vector is a space-like vector, and the corresponding slice is a time-like slice. Now in the Sutton case, the vector is a time-like vector, and the slice is a space-like. Okay, so now what you can show is that not only is probably that the norm of this vector is 1 on the boundary, but you can always choose such a defining function rho such that this is true in the neighborhood of infinity of the boundary of n. And one example is just to take the rho of x to be the distance with respect to this conformal metric of a point with respect to its boundary. And with respect to this defining function, the metric has the form written downstairs. So there is a radial direction, which is the rho square over rho square. And then there's a metric on the slice rho equal constant, which is gamma rho over rho square. It's sometimes useful to go from rho to the physical distance r, where the metric takes the other form. Next slide. And I'm happy to take questions if it's not clear, because it's not the usual subject. So,
are you thinking, this last equation, was it ds bar? Was it the metric of the completed space-time or the original space-time?
The metric ds squared is the metric of the original space-time. It's the physical metric. It's the physical metric. Because it blows up at rho equal to 0. So rho equal to 0 is really a space. Which is the case. Go to the next slide, that's it. So here I put back this physical metric. As you see, rho minus 2 gamma rho is the metric induced on the surface sigma rho. So sigma rho is the surface at constant rho, the time-like surface. In ADS, you have to think about it as being some type of time-like cylinder. As I say, this sigma rho has space-like for the digital scale, time-like in ADS, and infinity is really when rho is equal to zero. So infinity is a conformal cylinder. Yeah. Now, one of the key properties of such a type of geometry in the classical level, which is in fact going to explain lots of the property of ADS CFT, is the following fact. But if you look at the explicit curvature tensor of such a space, and have you seen such a space, so KIJ, then what happens is that if you go to infinity, then if you look around what happens near rho equal to zero, then the explicit curvature is going to just become proportional to the identity that I see up to terms of order rho. The explicit curvature is just the identity tensor. And why is this important? I've written the explicit curvature tensor with index right up and down. If you put the two index down, then the explicit curvature tensor is just proportional to the time like metric up to order rho squared.
So I think those two factors.
And this is somehow one of the reasons of, that leads to an heuristic reason for the ADS-CFT correspondence, and the rest of the talk is to make this heuristic, a very unwavy argument, more rigorous or more fleshy. But essentially, suppose that for some reason the physics of the system you're looking at is described by some type of wave function that depends on this gamma rho. So gamma rho is the induced metric up to this term rho square. And then let's look at the radial motion. So dr is the derivative with respect to the radial motion. So this cylinder is the cylinder at, which is... So each slice of labeled by rho or by r is a cylinder. And let me move this cylinder towards infinity. So if you look at what is the derivative acting on phi gives, well, you can expand it by the chain rule as a functional derivative and the derivative on the metric. Now the derivative on the metric is essentially the explicit curvature tensor, but when I go towards asymptotic infinity, the explicit curvature is just proportional to the metric itself, and the operator I get is this integral of gamma delta phi over delta gamma. And this operator, if you look a bit at it, is just a conformal rescaling operator. Right? It's the operator of conformal rescaling. It just counts the number of power of the metric there is, the number of times you raise the indices. And this is really the global conformal rescaling. Now, so what it means is that due to the cosmological constant, and I need L here, non-zero, the radial evolution is equivalent near infinity to conformal rescaling. And that's one of the key information. Then, of course, infinity is always left in bounds by radial evolution. That is the endpoint of radial evolution. So when you reach infinity, it means that the physics should be essentially conformal invariant. It should be the invariance under radial motion becomes conformal invariant. Okay, and that's somehow the heuristic basis for this correspondence that the physics should be described near infinity in a conformal invariant manner. Okay, next slide. So what is the original formulation, mainly due to Witten of the ADS-CFT? So ADS-CFT is an equivalence between, on one side, a quantum gravity partition function with fixed Dirichlet boundary conditions and the generating functional of connected correlation function of conformal fixed theory. So let me try to explain that. So namely, let's suppose that you have a set of fields that are living in the bulk, that I denote big phi, I, which could be a scalar field, And then, well, not exactly GNU, but more HNU, the graviton excitation around the metric, and then some other things, which are bulk things. Now, on the bulk side, what we want to compute is, so we first choose an asymptotic ADS spacetime, and then we look at all the possible fields leading on this ADS spacetime, which are encoding in an action for this bulk field, and then we want to compute the path integral over all, you know, field fluctuation, but with the restriction that this field on the boundary, sigma rho, is fixed to a value small phi I. Okay, so that gives us a functional which depends on sigma. Sigma is any time like, surface you like, topological surface you like, labeled by rho, and then it depends functionally on this phi I. You think about this subject, in fact, and of course you want to go towards rho equal to zero. So if you think about this construction, let's say in flat space, if you do the same construction in flat space, then conformal infinity will be null. But if you look at sigma rho, which is a bit away from flat space, you can slice it by some space-like surface. Then what this object would be is, as shown by Fadeyev and Slavnov a long time ago, is exactly the S matrix functional. That is, it is, you know, it's a functional of the field you put at asymptotic infinity, which is such that when you take derivative of this field, it produces S matrix elements. So one name I propose for this object is the ADS matrix functional, because it's the natural generalization of what you mean by S matrix function. So I hope this slide is clear. On the CFT side, to each boundary field phi I, an associated conformal operator of dimension delta I. So each field phi I, you know, carries some conserved charge like Lorentz indices, scalar field, the one four field, the graviton, etc. And it's also characterized by the wave transform when I rescale the metric. That is, when I rescale the metric this way by multiplied by rho minus 2, the field is rescaled in a way which is controlled by this conformal dimension. And then the equivalence is, given such an object, you can compute the generating. And given that these operators are in a CFT, you can compute the generating functional of correlated function, which is the expectation value of exponential integral of phi I or I, okay, which is the Z CFT of phi I. Now, the correspondence is that ADS CFT is the statement that given a zero quantum gravity, there exists a CFT such that we have the equality that psi of phi, evaluated at rho equal to zero, is equal to the partition function of a CFT of phi I. And that's the original correspondence. So I hope all the elements there are clear. If not, ask questions, but let's go to the next slide.
Okay, so, both Malvasena and Witten have formulated it specifically in the ADS side, not the DS side. Now, if I have the sitter, then this graph has two disconnected components, scribe plus and scribe minus.
Yes.
So you said that your considerations would be valid for both. So what do you, when you say boundary in the DS context, what do you mean?
So at this stage, because this is the original formulation, it's really strictly ADS. Okay. But when we will go to a background independent formulation, the two-sitter case will be also introduced. So at this stage, because this is the it's really only ADS. People have tried to copy a bit of this formulation by adding now two boundaries, but let me stick to the ADS case for this original formulation.
Okay.
So this is the original formulation, and psi of phi is equal to ZCFT of phi. But the problem is that when I first look at that, my very early reaction, because of the heuristic argument I gave you, was that, yeah, it's kind of obvious because I unnecessarily have conformal symmetry at the end. But my second reaction is that it's necessarily wrong, right? But let me put it that way, that in fact, if you look at this formulation, there are three puzzles that arise when you look at this formulation. And the understanding, the formulation, the understanding of the three puzzles are the key to the understanding of the correlation. So what are these three puzzles that this formulation has? The first one is, and this is a puzzle that has been recognized a long time ago, since the beginning almost. It's the fact that, well, this correlation, if you look at it, the left-hand side is evaluated as asymptotic infinity in a given space-time. But you can clearly see quite rapidly that even at the classical level, such an evaluation really lead to divergences. And these divergences need to be regularized. But you would say, okay, that's a technical problem. Okay, next slide. The second puzzle for me was a very serious one, and never really discussed before. Second puzzle is background independence. So if you look at the equivalence and the way I have formulated it, this equivalence refers explicitly to a background space-time. This background space-time needs to be in a DA space and needs to have an asymptotic infinity. And it also refers explicitly to a slicing of this background space-time because of this sigma rho, and rho is kind of coordinate there. However, as we know very well in quantum gravity, the metric is dynamical and information about the bulk geometry cannot be encoded into some choice of background metric, but it is really encoded into this choice of this functional, this AES matrix, you know, the way we would get this AES matrix, what Carlo calls this boundary space, right? We put some spin network on the boundary, and then we compute the amplitude, and we try to extract physics from there. So in quantum gravity, the way we think about it, the metric is not there, it's just encoded into this choice of psi. Now, if I have psi, I don't have a background metric, where is the asymptotic infinity? So the whole formulation rely on that. That's the second puzzle. The third puzzle is, next slide. The third puzzle is the most serious one, because this is supposed to be an equation between two objects that just have a functional dependence on the same data, like fields on the boundary, that I call phi I. But then you can start to look at what are the equations that the left-hand side and the right-hand side do satisfy. And they don't satisfy the same equation. The left-hand side, as we will see, satisfies some type of real debit equation, which is a second-order differential equation. The right-hand side satisfies an equation, which is an equation defining the conformality theory, which is a conformal wildline entity, and which is first-order. So how can we have equivalence between solutions of different equations of motion, and even more than that, the equivalence between the solutions of a first-order system with a second-order differential system. And
hello?
Yes?
Yeah, this is Lee. Would you agree with putting it the following way? The original conjecture or observation of Wiggins is a conjecture about a quantum field theory on a fixed background, which is asymptotically ADS. And there we can discuss whether there's evidence for that conjecture, and I think many people would say there's strong evidence for some precise form of that conjecture. What you're really doing is something different. What you're really doing is asking, is there a related property of quantum theories of gravity where there is no fixed metric that, as Wiggins requires for his formulation, is there some property of background-independent quantum gravity which is related to or analogous to? Because your puzzle 3 doesn't arise for Wiggins' formulation, because for Wiggins' formulation, the quantum field theory on the background satisfies some sort of Schrodinger equation. I think it's really because you're positing, you're trying to beyond Witten and Maldacena that you face these problems. And I think that's really the context or the way in which you might present it.
I would be a bit stronger than that. So concerning background independence, I would say that if your claim is that you have a theory that describes quantum gravity, then you have to solve background independence. And you cannot have a formulation of a theory which is describing bulk quantum gravity without somehow having a formulation which is truly background independent, in the sense I'm saying here, which is not referring to a classical asymptotic space-time. I think that you're not going to avoid that. I agree that the correspondence, I mean, if you talk about the correspondence and you don't worry about quantum gravity, it's fine. If you start to worry about quantum gravity, you have to worry about background independence. And the third remark applies even if you assume that there is a background space time, you don't worry about the dynamics of gravity, or you worry on about it as a graviton field, you will still have this problem, even in the original formulation. So I think it's already a problem of the original formulation, or a puzzle about the original formulation. It's not very acute there, because people don't really worry too much about quantum gravity, or don't worry about this question. So it did not, but it was recognized in some convoluted way, or if you put in the next slide, in some sense I said that these puzzles have already somehow a germ of, or have already a revolution in the literature. This is called holographic renormalization. But I think I would stick to the first thing. You can't deal, it seems to me, with quantum gravity without, you know, having a fixed background, because, you don't know exactly what are your, fundamental degrees of freedom, and so you have to face these questions. And in fact, these questions are clarifying for the correspondence, I think. Does that answer?
The rest is philosophy. Go ahead.
But we had this discussion many, many times, since here, right? Part of our workshop and so on. And their point would be not so take the original versions of Maldacena's written literally, but look at it slightly more generally. And they would say that what you have is boundary conditions. And it is certainly true that we can look at a sector of the theory. I mean, Steve Shankar, for example, agrees that it's a tiny sector of the theory. We can look at a tiny sector of the theory in which some boundary conditions are satisfied. And these boundary conditions are just put at infinity. And in the internal space-time, you allow the metric to be dynamical, no fixed metric, no fixed background metric, or anything like that. And when you are looking at this particle, the partition function, there you allow also the metric to vary in the inside, subject only to the condition that all the metrics considered are asymptotically identical.
So I agree with the statement, but you see, the goal here is not to just have these vague things about ADS-CFT that was said before, but a framework where you can say, well, how can I prove it? That is, what is exactly the statement I should? So at the end of the day, you will see that whatever the interpretation you have, you might go back to that and say what exactly is meant when people is saying that. But at some level, if you go around and ask, okay, I know everything about 3D gravity, what computation should I do to prove it? Well, this initial understanding is not enough, I think, to answer that. As you will see, I'm not really in conflict with what, I don't think I am. I'm just going a bit further away. I'm just saying that if you start to worry about this question, so I know that people say there's many reasons why we should not worry about this question. What I'm saying is that if you just start to worry about this question, suddenly the whole picture simplifies drastically. So it's a lesson I've taken from this. Somehow asking questions that look a bit more complicated or deeper simplify the whole interpretation. But I hope to convince you of that, at least.
Sure, let's go.
Okay, let's go to the next slide. I'm not sure I will have time, though, but... So let me look first a bit at these two sides, the gravity. I mean, let me look at these three puzzles. I say they don't satisfy the same equation of motion. That's a big turn-off, right? If you want to have an equality between A and B, in some sense, they should be the same thing. So if I look at the gravity equation of motion, well, so now I'm going to focus on pure quantum gravity with a twist with a kind of a background independent twist, if you want. So that is, I don't want to refer to any background space time. So in gravity, what type of things will we compute? You know, we will suppose that we have a space time, a topological space time with a boundary sigma. Then on this boundary, let's fix, you know, as you say, some boundary condition, a metric gamma, on the d-dimensional space sigma. Okay. And now I have this metric gamma, which is there. And then what I want to compute is this path integral, which is this integral over all metric of exponential I, S, the action, where the metric on the boundary is fixed to be gamma. Okay? And that's the subject psi sigma of gamma that I'm interested in. And somehow I assume here that somewhere I have a definition of quantum gravity, which makes sense, you know, which allows me to make sense of this path integral picture here. So in 3D, I have a precise, you know, formulation of that type of object. In general, in fact, whatever the theory of quantum gravity I have in the background, I can make sense of this object, at least at one loop or two loop or any number of loops. And let me stick at one loop level. And let me think about this object at least at one loop level. And my assumption is that any theory of quantum gravity, whatever it is, should agree with this one loop result. Okay? So here it is, for me, it's a formulation which is background independent. You know, there is no background space-time. I don't have to choose any preferred asymptotic slice. I don't have to choose a slice. I just have to choose a boundary metric, enough boundary data, and then integrate over whatever is inside. Okay? So if I look at the, that's a small difference, but that's a key difference with respect to the visual formulation. And that's the way we think about quantum gravity. These are just like boundary states. You know, imagine gamma as a spin network on some surface, and then we have a spin from amplitude that gives us what is the value of this object. I've written down the action. The unshaped variation of the action is proportional to the variation of the metric, if I include this Gibbons-Hawking boundary term here. The key thing is that if I use this unshaped variation, and if I look, if I also use the way the action change under bulk diffeomorphism, so for instance, you know, under in the last line, under small diffeomorphism labeled by psi, the action changed by a pure boundary term, which is psi n times the Lagrangian there. Next slide. Then, clearly, this partition function, as we know very well, satisfies an equation which is essentially some type of Ward identity expressing the diffeomorphism invariance of gravity. So, if I make a change of variation, you know, I make a change of variable of how this path integral change under diffeomorphism, I get an equation that I can write that is written just below. So, let me define, you know, pi, which is the momentum conjugate to gamma, so it's 2 over, you know, square root of gamma, the derivative with respect to gamma eb. I raise and lower indices with gamma eb on the boundary, and then, you know, pi is the root trace of gamma. And you can show that this state or this object, this ADS functional, satisfies two equations, an Hamiltonian type of equation and a Diffeo equation. The Diffeo equation is the usual one, that's a regularization of the change of diffeomorphism. And the other equation is the Willow-Debye equation. It's slightly different from the usual one because of the first sign, instead of having a plus sign there's a change of sign in the pi square, in the kinetic term. But otherwise, this is just some radial Willow-Debye equation, okay? The only difference is that gamma is a time-like metric, but otherwise there's nothing different. There's some dots around the pi, and it denotes renormalization that you have to carry out explicitly at any loop order in order to subtract the singular parts of the boundary-to-boundary propagator. I mean, if you look at pi acting on the object which is on the first line, you see that clearly it involves computing two-point function at the same point. These two-point functions at the same point have singular parts, you know, dynamics, so you can subtract this singular Green function. And this subtraction can be not loop by loop order. So at one loop order, it's well-defined, at two loop order, it's well-defined, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a beautiful you know, there's a beautiful theory behind that, which was first developed by Simancic. Okay, so that's the equations of gravity. Nobody is really surprised by that. Next slide. Just here, I want to emphasize that this equation is, of course, second order. So imagine that I split the metric in terms of gamma hat and the conformal factor phi, where, for instance, gamma hat is a determinant 1. And the same thing, I split the phi in terms of the trace part and then something that acts on gamma hat only. Then you don't need to look really at the detail of h, but what I want to emphasize is that h is something like delta phi squared, plus an operator that actually of gamma hat, kinetic operator, and then the potential term. The potential term is always r plus lambda. So clearly, this equation is a relativistic equation. So what does that mean, that this is a relativistic equation? It means that if you think, you know, it's an Hamiltonian equation, so I can think of it as some type of, you know, time evolution equation, where here time is this field, phi of x. And what it means is that, generically speaking, one expects existence of non-trivial propagating kernels, which depends on this phi, so I do know this kernel k phi and k tilde of phi, which are such that the value of phi is gained by exponential 2 phi, so I wrote on the left phi of exponential 2 phi of gamma hat, is just the convolution of phi and its derivative, you know, integrating over all possible metrics. Because it's second order, clearly the initial data is determined not only by phi of gamma hat, but also by the you know, derivative of phi of gamma hat is phi. Okay, next slide. So that's all for the gravity equation so far. Now, what is the CFT, the conformal field? You might be less familiar with that, but the CFT has a very, and we are interested here on pure gravity. So the CFT phi, what does it mean to be interested in the gravity? Means that we're interested only on the partition function of the CFT. So imagine I have a CFT which coupled to a metric, you know, some field coupled to a metric. I integrate out all the field of the CFT. I get a partition function, or something that depends on the metric I have chosen. Okay. Now, what does it mean that this object is a conformal field theory? It means that this object has to satisfy two equations, which are the conformal wild identity. One of these equations is exactly the same as the gravity equation. It's the equation that says that this conformal field theory is a default invariant. Okay, so that's the first equation. Invariant under small conformal. The second equation is the equation that expresses that this theory should be invariant under local distribution. So on the left-hand side, you know, I take the partition function of CFT and I take variation with respect to the UV field or the scaling field phi equals zero. And it should be, if it was exactly conformally invariant, it would be equal to zero. But in general, there's an anomaly term. So there's a term which is I, the anomaly of AGX of Z CFT. So as it says in the blue line, the left-hand side says that it's invariant under local rescaling, and the right-hand side is the anomaly. I'm going to explain a bit what is an anomaly, but essentially, what is a CFT? A CFT partition function is a solution of this equation in a given dimension, and what is the classification of all CFT is to be able to find a solution of these two equations. And plus another one, which is modular invariant. So what is the anomaly? You can show that for an odd dimensional space, the anomaly is necessarily zero. So you have exact conformal invariants always. Now in dimension two, in general, the anomaly is a functional of the boundary metric of a certain degree. So for instance, dimension two, the only degree two you know, default invariant operator I can write the metric, the curvature. So dimension two, the anomaly is characterized by just one number, which is the central charge, C. In dimension four, there are a priori the basis of dimension four curvature operators are bigger, but it's essentially two numbers now, A and C. A is proportional to the Euler density, tensor is proportional to the y squared tensor. These are the two standard charge. And then there's always possibility to rescale the terms like alpha box r by terms which are which can arise from a local variation. Box r can arise from the variation of r squared, for instance. So it's not considered an anomaly. Okay? So the space of OCFT, for instance, in 2D is to solve these two equations with the condition that, with a fixed central charge scheme. And this is a big, very big still open problem. There's an extra condition that I will not impose here, I will not talk much about it, which is that you also have to ask for modular invariants. That is, not only you ask usually when you have a CFT for invariants under small diffeomorphism, which is the first equation here, but you also ask for invariants under large diffeomorphism. Okay? And that's some extra requirements. That this is not a modular invariant, not something which is obvious from the right hand side, so it's something to do. Okay, so let's move to the next slide. Now that we have seen the two sides of the puzzle, we start to ask, I want to ask the three questions, the puzzle. So the first one that is the key to the resolution is really background independence. The key point is just to remember that at the classical level, so now we don't have on the gravity side, as you remember, there's no background space time. But at the classical level, if you remember that the property of asymptotic infinity, in fact, are not put by n. They just follow dynamically from solving the ancient equation. For instance, the fact that the boundary is time-like in the ABS case is not something you put. It's something that is a result of the ancient equation. The fact that the normal vector field is of norm 1 is not put by n. So all these properties of the asymptotic infinity are truly fully dynamical at the classical level. So here, the strategy to say is the same, that we don't have a background, but clearly the property of asymptotic infinity should come dynamically from the quantum Einstein equation, which is the radial of the Ludovic equation we have written. And it should also come from the fact that there is some limit, you know, of rho goes to zero or some conformally. In the classical level, the only thing you assume is that there exists some conformal space time. That's the only thing you assume. All the rest is purely dynamical.
Are you assuming anything on the metric gamma? Are you assuming it to be conformally flat or anything like that?
No. The metric gamma is as arbitrary as it can be. This is really the argument of a wave function.
Okay.
So exactly, that's the point. So at the quantum level now, we don't have a space-time, but the quantum space-time is represented by psi of gamma, right? So it's represented by this wave function. So where is the asymptotic infinity? Now, it's not too complicated. If you remember, at the classical level, the induced matrix scales as gamma over rho squared near infinity. So, and if you think about what is the meaning of psi of gamma, you need to specify psi of gamma for any metric gamma. So at the quantum level, at the classical level, gamma is somehow the metric induced on a slice that you give in a given space-time. But at the quantum level, it's the reverse. The knowledge of psi of gamma for every gamma is in fact how you reconstruct your space-time. Okay? The way you reconstruct your space-time from a quantum state is because you know what is the value or the physics of your space-time, you know, on a given slide, but not on a particular slide, on any possible slide. And the set of all possible slicing is really, you know, the set of all possible embedding of your surface in a given space-time. So that's where your space-time reappears. So clearly, in order to look at asymptotic infinity, one needs to look at the behavior of psi. When you take the argument gamma over rho squared, that is when gamma gets bigger and bigger, if you want, in the limit where rho goes to zero. And that is for a solution of the Ludovic equation. So asymptotic infinity is no longer a locus in a space-time, it's just an asymptotic property of a wave function. Okay, that's what it means in this formulation. So next slide. So let's look at one of the key lemma, which is proven in the paper is the following. If you look at the at a solution of radial Willebrand equation. Now we wanted to look at this asymptotic property of the Willebrand solution because this is where infinity is located somewhere. So the lemma is that if I look at such a solution of radial Willebrand equation, then the asymptotic solution of the solution in rho goes to zero given by this formula, psi of gamma over rho squared, is asymptotic to, there's two terms that arise, exponential is local times z plus, and plus exponential minus is local z minus. Now, s local or gamma, it's an explicit local action which contains terms of dimension at most d over 2. So we will see the expression for that. But local means that it's a function of gamma, which is d for invariant. So it starts, it depends just on the volume, and then the integral of r, and then the integral of r squared. And then you stop, if it's dimension 4 plus 1, you stop at r squared. If it's dimension 2 plus 1, you stop at r. And the next thing is that z plus and minus are, if you look at this asymptotic, you find that the property that comes from the Willebrand equation is that z plus and minus are a pair of conformation theory. That is, they are a solution of Ward identity, which is written down with a specific type of anomaly and a specific type of central charge, which is fixed by G Newton and lambda. And this conformal Ward identity, CFT equation, if you want, is just a leftover, or it is an holographic imprint of the Willebrand equation onto asymptotic infinity. And you can think about this expansion, which is there as some type of Born-Oppenheimer expansion, where you take infinity to be the AZ component, and the rest, the CFT, to be the light component. Next slide. So this property really follows from Willebrand equation. So I've put there again the asymptotic formula. So this formula is true for any solution of radial Willebrand equation. So what does that mean? So first thing we see in this formula is that a general quantum gravity state corresponds to a pair of CFTs, not to one CFT. And clearly this follows from the fact that we're solving a second order differential equation and not a first order one. So there should be two pieces of initial data. Now, if we want to understand, and this is a bit at odds with the usual formulation where only one CFT arrives. So, but if we look at the explicit curvature operator, which is essentially coming from applying this momentum operator phi acting on psi, you can see that because one term comes with exponential is and the other comes with exponential minus is, you can show that the first term, when you apply this operator and indefinite, would correspond to explicit curvature plus delta ij plus order o squared, and the other term would become minus delta ij. So the first term here corresponds to reaching asymptotic infinity, in fact, from the inside of the space-time, right? The explicit curvature has the right sign, the positive sign, so it's really like an expanding slice. Whereas the other term doesn't really have a semi-classical interpretation because it would correspond to reaching asymptotic infinity from the outside. So clearly, it points down towards the following interpretation that if I want to really have a state that is would correspond semi-classically to a space-time with one asymptotic end, then I need to assume that the minus of gamma is equal to zero. This part is not there, right? Because adding this part here is something which is really not semi-classical. I mean, it cannot be interpreted as adding asymptotic infinity. And this state with that minus equal to zero is, in some sense, the quantum definition of what we mean by having an asymptotic infinity ADA space. Okay. It's interesting to note that the derivation here, in fact, is true even if the corresponding space-time I'm talking about is compact, because I've never assumed that the space-time has or has not an asymptotic infinity. So, if the space-time is compact, if there's no asymptotic infinity, the statement I'm making still holds, but the interpretation of these two CFTs is less clear.
So my question is, why is the fundamental lemma true? Because the fundamental lemma was really true in some limits, right?
The fundamental lemma is the one written above. You take psi of gamma over rho squared, and you look at it. And this is just coming out from the property of the Willer-Levitt equation.
Yeah, but aren't you taking rho equal to
zero? Yes,
Doesn't that correspond in your formalism somehow to going to infinity? Because
it should, yeah. So semi-classically it should. But now if I have imagine that I have a state psi of gamma. This state is defined for every gamma. And you know, even if the corresponding space-time is compact, it is still defined for every gamma.
Right, but I don't see the idea. I mean, the argument of psi is gamma upon rho squared, and we're driving rho to zero.
Yes.
And so if the space-time is compact, I don't understand the meaning of this operation.
There's no semi-classical meaning, I agree with you. Now we are at the quantum level, so a wave function, you know, can be supported, can have support, can have support away from its classical support. So we can still talk about the property of the wave function in some region, which is that, you know, has no classical support.
But even in quantum theory, you want to think of gamma as a boundary metric, don't you? Because what is the meaning of the mathematical symbol gamma?
Well, it's some type of boundary metric, but it might.
Okay, so the boundary may not be at infinity, I agree, but now if it is compact, then this boundary metric can just go to zero if I take the limit of rho going to zero, right? Because it's gamma upon rho squared, which is an argument of the wave function.
I think, whatever, this asymptotic property is true. It's from this asymptotic property that you would see. I mean, think about, I don't know, some type of confining potential or in some sense, when z plus and z minus are both non-zero, what I have is that asymptotic infinity, I can think of it as some type of reflecting wave, and instead of having only outgoing wave at infinity, I have outgoing wave and incoming wave, and somehow they kind of cancel. You know, I can imagine something like that, and so I never really truly reach in the state knows about this limit, but the space time doesn't. I don't see any problem with that. And certainly this is something that needs to be understood further. What is the exact meaning of? If you compute a state for a compact space-time, it's not going to be that psi has support only for certain type of gamma and then has no support outside. Because this is not consistent with the Willer-Levitt equation. Psi should have support on any metric, even the one which are big. And this is really, I think, you know, this is from the property of this state that you read out you read out whether this space-time is semi-classical, for instance.
My question is really that your fundamental lemma is not true unless you take the limit rho goes to zero, right?
The fundamental lemma, as it is stated before, is a statement about the limit gamma over rho square with rho going to zero. There's a similar sign here.
Okay, so one is always taking the limit. So in a compact case, if it is really completely compact, let me just divide the question into two parts. The first part, because you are mixing the two things, the first part is that we really have infinity, and then you do have this equation, and there is a meaning to this particular to this particular equation, to the solution, where z minus is not equal to zero, and that there are really these two ways, and that part I agree completely with.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go with the first part, and you agree. Let's go back to the slide on the lemma. The first part is just a statement. Any solution of Willer-Levitt equation has this asymptotic behavior. That's the statement. Any solution, all of them. All.
As rho goes to zero, yes.
As rho goes to zero, any of them. Even if I can have classical solutions that don't have asymptotic infinity. So all of them. Okay? And then, and then the second statement is that only some of them I can decently interpret them as having, you know, an infinity, and that's the minus equals.
Yeah, I think I agree with those statements. When
you start
talking about compact,
let's go on. Okay, so that's the first thing. Now, suppose that we take z minus equal to zero for simplicity. I mean, we look only at such states. Even for such states, what happens is that, what is the meaning of this boundary CFT? This boundary CFT is essentially just the initial data that determine size. On the slice, which is not in the box, but which is the slice sigma zero at asymptotic infinity. So the conformal VC repartition function is just some initial data, which determines then fully the gravitational state from the Hamiltonian evolution. So clearly, the correspondence is not one-to-one. That is, it's not a correspondence between one theory of quantum gravity and one CFT. At most, what it is that it's a correspondence for each radial state, for each solution of radial velocity equation as one conformality theory. So, from the point of view of theory, this is a correspondence between one theory of quantum gravity to many CFTs.
No, definitely. I mean, it could also be, I mean, at the moment, you just solve this velocity equation.
Yeah.
But really, you have to construct a physical Hilbert space. And when you construct a physical Hilbert space via group averaging, it's quite possible, as in simple models, it does happen. And in fact, you just pick up some super selection, or you either pick up one factor or another factor. And so it could well be.
Oh, the minus, let me not discuss the Z minus. The second part, which is, I think, even more important, is really the one. Are you discussing the one too many? The one too many is, you know, but there is not going to be only one solution of quantum gravity equation solution. There are going to be many solutions. That's all I'm saying. And for each solution, there is a corresponding CFT, which is a priori totally different. It has a different field content. It has a different you know, symmetry. It has radically different.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you there.
Okay. And then, yeah, the other thing I need to emphasize is that when I say state here, I really mean radial state. So this is part of the question. I'm not going to address that, but the question is, what is the relationship between such a radial state and the usual notion of state? The radial state is defined on this time-like slice, and the usual notion of state is defined on the space-like slice. Okay, what you can argue for, but I don't want to discuss now, is that a radial state is equivalent to some type of density matrix in terms of usual gravity states. For instance, in the De Sitter case, you will have the same statement. You will have a priori these two, Z plus and Z minus. So there it makes more sense because there's potentially an outgoing infinity and an ingoing infinity. And then this state is a combination of these two states and looks more like the data it corresponds to is similar to density matrix data. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. So clearly, these first things, you know, this formula allows us to lead to a resolution of the puzzle. First, the technical puzzle, clearly the infinity are exactly subtracted by this term as local of gamma. Okay. How much time do I have? 10 minutes? Or?
Yes, approximately.
But if there is discussion, which is
very interesting,
reasonably soon.
Okay, so let me try to wrap it up. So the infinities are exactly subtracted by S local of gamma. The background freeness, well, asymptotic infinity is just the asymptotic behavior of psi gamma. And then the equations, well, the CFT world identity is really the holographic imprint of the Willow-DeWitt equation at infinity. So secretly, they are the same. And the resolution of first order versus second order is that, well, one gravity solution generically corresponds to two CFT and not one. And restricted to one is physically relevant, I think, but it's a restriction. It's really a restriction of being adding an infinity. Next slide.
Can I ask a question? Yes. There are certain manifolds with several asymptotic regions. Does this just multiply that if you need two conformal field theories for each asymptotic region?
Yeah, a priori, when I say sigma, I was kind of assuming that sigma is connex, right? Is a connex sigma. Now, if it's not connected, which would mean several asymptotic regions, then a priori, I will have a CFT for each connected region. I might want to restrict to states which have always the same CFT in any asymptotic region, and there might be something which is physically meaningful or semi-classically meaningful, but generally speaking, I mean, if you imagine a multi-black hole like in 2+1, it's not, you know, you could have several asymptotic regions, but there's no reason that on one asymptotic end, the black hole UC can have a mass in the spin. On another asymptotic end, the black hole UC has a different mass and a different spin. And then the CFT there will have some different. The difference there will just be the temperature of the spin. Some coupling constant might be different. So, what I'm saying is clearly, it's true, for sigma, I don't really, it's true for connex and non-connex sigma. Okay? Next slide. The problem then I have, because I still wanted to, prove or disprove in the CFT, so we are in bad shape here, because clearly I say that in some sense, and what I'm going to say is even stronger, that any conformality theory, any solution of the conformal world identity corresponds to a quantum gravity state. I'm going to give you a proof of that, or a claim of a proof of that in 2D. But that's what it means. So then what does it mean to identify the CFT dual to gravity, if any of them is some quantum state? Well, what you should think is that then we want to have a sensitive ball restriction on the type of radial quantum gravity state we have. And in some sense, what we call the CFT associated to quantum gravity should be the CFT associated to the most semi-classical state of quantum gravity. Okay, something like that. So I have to have a criteria to select a preferred notion of radial state. And the thing I propose here, and it appears here and there, I'm going to formulate it in the Euclidean context, because in the Lorentzian context, this is way more complicated, and I don't have time to state it here. But imagine I have, all I said before could be true also about Euclidean quantum gravity, which I don't know how to define even in 3D, but assuming that at least semi-classical it makes sense. So in that case of Euclidean quantum gravity, I would have the same statement that any Euclidean quantum gravity state, give me a CFT. And any CFT gives me a quantum gravity state. So, but there would be a preferred class of gravity state. So suppose I fix on the boundary, for instance, a toroid. Right? And then among all the possible quantum gravity states that could live on this toroid, I would like to look for the one that really is some type of outer locking state, that is, it's really the state coming from integrating all metric inside the toroid, where inside the toroid means that I fix the topology inside to be a handle body, to be a plane torus, okay, to be the simplest, so I fill this toroid by the simplest topology inside, and then I integrate over all metrics there, and that gives me a definition of a preferred quantum gravity state, and this quantum gravity state in terms of like the most semi-classical one, and then it makes sense given this preferred quantum gravity state to ask what is the CFT associated to this particular quantum gravity state, and only then it makes sense. And that's
from my construction, you're going from the bulk state quantum gravity state to the boundary CFT state, right? But of course, there could be several bulk states which give you the same CFT as well. Why is that precluded?
You're right. I haven't looked at that. It might be, I would say, it might be an accident, but it might be. I would expect...
No, but you're taking some limit, and it could well happen.
Yeah, so let me say, at the classical level, it's not true in the following sense. So if I get a classical question, so it's not true locally. It might be true globally, but suppose I give some type of CFT on the boundary, which means some type of preferred energy momentum tensor, and then I try to extend this metric inside, then you can show that at least locally, it's an invertible map. So you don't have this point. There might be some global problem. So you know that changing locally the CFT is really changing the background. So,
I agree that the issues are global. That the key thing is going to be global, not just yet.
Yeah. So it might be that there is some, and then I agree that it might be, but here I'm worrying about the other side, that a priori,
I understand. But just to sort of give them benefit of doubt, they might just say that, well, what one really has is really equivalent class of quantum gravity states, which all have the same CFT, and there will be another equivalent class which will have the same CFT,
yeah.
And what they're capturing when they're doing this is really, I mean, that's fixing a particular CFD, like, for example, the super youngest theory in T equal to 4, is a sector of quantum gravity, a whole bunch of infinite dimensional space of states of quantum gravity, which are being captured by this one CFD. But of course, they're not capturing everything, as you said. There is completely something disconnected, okay? So that is, a priori, that's a possibility.
In fact, you can even be more precise. So that is for this super young case. You can ask how many CFT, you know, I'm saying I should look for all CFT. You know, if I say how many CFT in dimension 4, there is 156, the central charge, and the field content. Suppose that you only perceive the field content, the central charge, is the coupling constant. And then you ask how many CFT there are in dimension 4, which has n equal 4 supersymmetry. And the answer is only one.
So
the same thing is true for the gravity state. If you look for how many solutions of gravity there is, which is exactly equal to the symmetry, there's only one. So, it doesn't contradict what I'm saying. It's just saying that there's a notion of a unique CFT because what you fix as the radial space is just, the symmetry, the symmetry solution.
The gravity side argument is formal, or whatever. How do I know
there's
a unique state in gravity
side and n equal 4? N equal 4, which respects all the symmetry? I think,
yeah. All the symmetries with symmetry. It's just that if you mark them in the...
2D, supersymmetry, n equal 4.
So where does that come from?
The solution. Any time dependent solution would break parts of the 2D, right? You know, it's like how many solutions of GR have exact conformal Lorentz, environment or Poincaré environment. That case, right?
Let us talk about it. Okay,
let's go. Yeah. It's like Poincaré environment. If you ask, the theory is Poincaré environment, but the states are not necessarily. Okay. So let's go to the next slide. Let's see. Okay, this is the proof. So let me skip the next three slides about the proof, and let's go to the slide on the reconstruction formula. So before I was giving the proof, but it's technical, it's in the paper. Now, if the CFT is some initial data, so now we just say that the CFT is just, can be interpreted as some initial data associated to a surface at infinity. Then it means that one should be able to reconstruct the bulk solution from the boundary, by an Hamiltonian evolution and via a propagating kernel. So can we do it in general? So in general, I don't know, but in 2 plus 1, next slide, we can do it explicitly. And then next slide for the formula. Okay. And here is another lemma, which is maybe the main claim of the work I've done. This is the reconstruction formula, which is explicit in 2 plus 1. It's, I don't know, it's just an amazingly simple formula. The proof is very long, very convoluted. It took me a while to find it. I don't know why, I don't know exactly why it's so simple. It's, so here's the formula. So if you give me any two-dimensional CFT with a given central charge C, then I can construct a solution of radial zero debit equation, which has as the asymptotic these given CFT ZC. And for that, I need to go to the first order formalism. So the boundary metric is two-dimensional, so it can be written in terms of a Wierbein field, E plus, E minus. And then the wave functional should be, DCO, gauge invariant, etc. And then given Z, I define a wave function, psi of E plus and E minus, in the following way. There's the first term, which is exponential I, k over 2 pi, the integral of the determinant of the Wierbein field, so this is like the area of sigma. And then there's a path integral, which is the integral of all Wierbein field labeled by the E plus. And this integral is over Zc of Bt, but there's an interpolating kernel, which is extremely simple. This interpolating kernel is just the integral of the wedge product of Be minus small e wedge Be minus small e. So if you think about it, there's nothing less you could write, that reconstruct this. Don't say this kernel is like a refocusing kernel. Clearly, if you look at what psi of small e depends on, it depends on all possible value of the boundary partition function. But there's kind of a quadratic kernel that refocuses this value to be around big E equal to small e, and then there's a spread. Okay? And the question is that the C should be equal to 1 plus 6k, there's a one loop renormalization, which is shown to be true at every loop, so this is a fully non-derivative result, and k is just the ratio of L with G. So that's I don't know, the formula to stare at. But it tells us that, yes, any CFT can give me a bulk quantum gravity state. Now, it might be that many of these quantum gravity states, I don't know how to interpret it. Many of them don't have a nice semi-classical interpretation. Many of them don't correspond to nice semi-classical spacetime. Many of them might have singularities or some, you know, and that is, I don't know, I mean, that is one of the things to understand, how you can track these properties of spacetime from the CFT on the boundary. Okay, but at least among the CFT, there might be one nice CFT which corresponds to at least both spacetime that have eternal black holes. That would be the one you would like to look at. Okay, next, forget the next slide, sorry about that. Like to the conclusion. So as we have seen, the gravity ADS matrix satisfies the radial Willebrand equation. The asymptotic value of any solution of this radial Willebrand equation is controlled by a pair, not one, but a pair of CFTs. Restricting to one CFT is equivalent to looking at asymptotic spacetime, which have an asymptotic infinity. That's the claim. The correspondence is one to many, the difference between radial states, all radial states of gravity and boundary CFTs. We can give in 2 plus 1 dimension an explicit reconstruction formula for a radial state from any boundary CFT. And we have proposed a particular radial state to study in order to identify the CFT dual to gravity. There are many open questions, Lorentzian versus Euclidean. I won't talk too much about that. What is the relationship between these radial states and usual states of quantum gravity, or more likely density matrix of quantum gravity? There's also the question of the sitter versus ADS. Most of what I say are true for the sitter, but there are some important differences. What is the meaning of this CFT, which we just discussed? How do you reconstruct, which one corresponds to nice semi-classical spacetime, for instance? Thank you.
Okay, so we have about 10 minutes for questions.
This is John Engel. I have a question. This is perhaps a very basic question, but rather early on in the, I think it was the fifth slide, there was a slide entitled Classical Basis of ADS CFT, and I just wanted to understand something better. When you show that the radial Willebrand equation is equivalent near infinity to conformal rescaling, I was confused because at first I thought psi was a function of the metric gamma at a constant rho, but then you write the derivative of gamma with respect to r, so it seems that psi is actually a function of the entire space-time metric, maybe the solution to Einstein's equation?
Sorry for the confusion. It's true that I derivative with respect to r, but if you look at upstairs, there's a relation between rho and r. So d over dr is like rho times d over dr. So what I'm looking at is just, I'm assuming, it's a very heuristic argument. I'm assuming that the functional depends only on the gamma on the slice. And I'm looking, it's not really below the equation here. I'm just looking at radial motion. How does this function change when I change r? And the radial motion is a motion in rho or in r, equivalency of the factor.
It seems that you're assuming that, when you take the derivative with respect to r, then that seems that the point is that you're taking a derivative off of the rho equals constant surface. So it seems that psi would have to be a function of the space-time metric.
In some sense, okay, psi, I agree, psi, in some sense, psi knows about gamma of rho for all rho. So in some sense, it knows about all space-time, yes, I agree with that.
So could I say that psi is a function of a point in the covariant phase space of the space of classical solutions?
Yes.
So if that's the case, normally wave functions would be a function of a configuration variable. So it seems
it's a function, it's a function of gamma on the slice. Now, if I change the slice, I change the argument of gamma. Gamma can change, right? Gamma rho can change. Here I'm identifying, if you want, suppose that I have phi of gamma, a function in phi of gamma, then what I'm saying is that there exists an operator, which is essentially the explicit curvature operator integrated over a slice, that tells me how to rescale the matrix, right? And this operator is a derivative operator in the matrix, and I'm giving a semi-classical interpretation to this operator, okay?
Think of R as being time, and then the question is really what happens under time evolution, quote unquote, of this relativity, the solution of the relativity equation.
Yes,
and
yes, I understood that.
Right. So it is really a function of a three metric, but still, if it is a solution of the equation, then you know how it changes if you give a particular lattice, and normally it will change, by extrinsic curvature times delta by delta metric, and that's what is happening here. Except that extrinsic curvature is very special.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And this is the difference of the lattice, one in the R coordinate and one of the rho square in the rho coordinate.
Okay, I would just, a general confusion basically, which is that, because it seemed to me that you are saying something which might be qualitatively different from what string theory people often say, even allowing for vagueness, sort of thing. Namely, they would say that the following, that I have to have asymptotically ADS space-time, and if I consider that there's boundary conditions which are asymptotically ADS, then they say that you are forced to have conformal field theory. And the argument is that, well, in this case, what is a symmetry group? So the symmetry group is the ADS group, because your asymptotic flatness, asymptotic ADS space-time, and the symmetric group at infinity is just the ADS group by itself. And then the statement is that, however, ADS group is also isomorphic to the conformal group on the boundary. The ADS group in the full space-time is isomorphic to the conformal group on the boundary. And therefore, this is a symmetric group, and anything that you have must be must give representations of this symmetric group, and that is how you are related to the conformal field theory. Mm-hmm. But the way you are presenting it, the symmetric group and so on is completely gone out of the window, because as you emphasized several times, you could just take these surfaces, they don't have to be at the sky of ADS, right?
I agree with you. This global symmetric group is gone. But in fact, if you look at the derivation, still an argument about symmetry group, but the symmetry group I'm really looking at here is the diffeo symmetry group. So I'm just saying the gravity state is diffeo invariant, diffeo on the bulk, and essentially the diffeomorphism symmetry group at infinity, that is after this rescaling, becomes the local conformal group. And that's in agreement with what you could do at the classical basis. So
But all your arguments hold even in the zero cosmological constant case?
Oh, no. In the zero cosmological constant case, I can't, exactly because of this slide that Jonathan was pointing out. In the zero cosmological constant case, I don't have that the explicit curvature becomes the identity, so I don't have, let's go to the slide proof one. Okay, let's go to the slide proof one, not for the proof, but there's the formula of this. This is slide proof one, and this is slide proof. Yes, here I write down, the action as local. So are you there? And as you see, the action is local. The first term contains a 1 over L. I can't take a limit L goes to 0. It doesn't make any sense. So I really need to have this. In some sense, the fact that when I go to infinity, the the solution of Milo-Dobbs equation as a local part, a part which is of this form, purely local in terms of gamma, because in general the log of the wave function is the horrendous non-local functional, right, if you try to write it down. But when you take this limit, lots of these horrendous non-local terms are gone away because of the cosmological constant. And the limit splits into this local part, which is there, and then the CFT part. And this is truly, you know, I need this number. I thought a bit about what I could say, but I don't think I can say anything which makes
sense. For the last quick conclusion. So the statement would be that you could do this in the, I can talk to you in the Fitter space time, where you go to time like infinity, basically.
Yes.
And there you want to repeat the same kinds of arguments.
Yes.
But if I were to take, say, ordinary asymptotically flat space, but I don't want to go to scrap. I still want to go to time-like infinity, which has been understood. It's also hyperboloid. It has all kinds of structure. And that limit, you're saying, you cannot handle.
No, I cannot have the asymptotic limit. I don't know. I cannot make the same lemma.
Okay. Stefan Alexander has a question.
Hi, Laurent, hi, Lee.
Hi.
Let's see. I have two kind of questions. I'll try to separate them, two quick questions. The first question is that in the ordinary formulation of the dictionaries that Witten produced, there was a sense in which the expectation was that there were certain degrees of freedom, looking from the supergravity point of view, that there were boundary values of the supergravity fields that asymptotic to ADS, the asymptotic flat space, that acted as sources to the CFT, the primary operators. And there was a picture that you had Wilson lines living on the Young Mills theory that are bounded by string Weyl sheets. So there's a sense in which, you know, the degrees of freedom and above have a natural extension to the degrees of freedom in the boundary. So my question to you is, what is your expectation of this formulation for what the degrees of freedom are in the quantum gravity theory and how they relate to the degrees of freedom in the CFT?
That's a tough question. For the first part, let's say that it's still a bit like that. I'm talking, the whole talk was about pure quantum gravity, and then you might want to put some other things. But even in pure quantum gravity, the partition function depends on gamma, and if I vary gamma is the boundary metric, and it's dual to an operator on the CFT, which is the energy momentum tensor. And this is really like the source of gravitational field in the box. So when I vary gamma on the boundary, I'm exciting the gravitational mode in the box. So this is still, it still has the same picture or the same, flavor. Now, the second point is that here I'm looking at the only local operators on the boundary, like derivative of gamma at some point. It would be interesting to see, what is the month to have non-local operators? How you excite non-local operators in the boundary for the string world sheet? And then for the more general question, I don't think it changed some of the interpretation of the usual correspondence. If you go to a gravity background and to a perturbative sector of the CFT, then it's fine. I was more trying to address the purely quantum gravity side. But it might shape some...
If I can interrupt, I think the key point is, or at least I thought, that it does change completely the expectation from the usual ADS CFT, because you're claiming that pure general relativity has dual conformal field theories, whereas a standard expectation has been that the only theories that have dual conformal field theories are string theories or theories with sufficient supersymmetry to be low energy limits of string theories. And you seem to be directly contradicting that, and that would seem to me to be important.
Yeah. It's hard for me to say, because one of the reasons of this work was to try to find out what is ADS CFT, what is the statement. And I went around and asked many different people, and I tried to look in the literature, and I never seen a precise statement of what it meant. So I have to be very cautious here. It might be that this contradicts what people think it is, but it might be it's in agreement. Honestly, I already gave this several times in front of string theorists, experts of ADS CFT, And I had the whole range of reactions from it is very different to yeah, we knew about it. So I think it puts some light on this correspondence. I think this is the right way to look at it now. I think it contradicts what I thought the SCFT was, you know, what I understood about it, but
Would not be hard to find statements in the literature.
I
think I completely agree with Lee that it is probably true that some people have talked about string theory, might have thought about this, and might have known that there is freedom. But certainly that is not the general picture that is communicated when people give talks on ADS-CFT. I mean, not colloquium level talks, even technical talks. I think I agree with Lee completely that the picture that is given is that really it has something to do with string theory and supersymmetry is absolutely essential.
So I agree. That's why, at that level I agree. That is, at some level the picture is that there's one, you know, it's a one-to-one correspondence. So that clearly is no longer in some sense something you can say maybe honestly after this work. I agree. So that was one of the things I wanted to clarify, because now in some work you could see that people know that if you change the CFT Hamiltonian, it's still kind of some gravity state, right? So changing the CFT Hamiltonian means changing the CFT. What I'm saying is that you can be even more drastic than that. You can even change the field content. Cautious on that. I know that it contradicts maybe the colloquium level statement about it. Yes. It's not one to one. Clearly not. Yeah.
Okay, so we've gone on for an hour and a half. We should probably end this. So, Laurent, if you want to say one last thing, and then we conclude.
Okay.
Laurent, can you call me in the next hour or so? I have any other questions that I would like to discuss.
Okay.
Any of your time. Okay.
Thanks. Okay.